Welcome to the PERS podcast. My name is Yana Hlistova, and we are changing the conversation for women about money and investing. I'm super excited about my guest today, Pierre Rolland. Pierre is founder and CEO of Ank Impact Ventures, a Canadian entrepreneur with over 35 years of real estate investment advisory, as well as venture capital experience. Pierre was previously based in London, Frankfurt, and New York, and has closed more than 550 real estate investments valued in excess of $17 billion and delivered an average of 20% IRR for his clients. Pierre was appointed Global Head of Credit Suisse International Real Estate, based in London, at the age of 35. Following his career at Credit Suisse, Pierre founded a global real estate advisory firm where he managed assets of $6.4 billion, including 125 direct properties and four customized private equity real estate funds. Pierre is currently chairman and CEO of Ank Real Estate Incorporated, and independent global real estate investment advisory firm whose clients include ultra high net worth private investors, foundations, private equity firms, alternative managers, and property developers. In 2006, Pierre established a private nonprofit grant-giving foundation that promoted learning opportunities for gifted, underserved youth through art, education, and cultural heritage programs. From 2015 to 2020, Pierre advised and invested in over 20 venture-backed early-stage growth and late-stage technology companies. Based on these experiences and a desire to create sustainable social impact beyond philanthropic giving, Pierre established Ank Impact Ventures in 2020 with a new philanthro-capitalist business model to foster impact entrepreneurship by diverse agents of change from all global geographies. Pierre has shared his experiences at numerous conferences and events globally, such as the World Economic Forum in Davos, the Milken Institute Global Conference in Los Angeles, and the Young President's Organization in London. Now, in this podcast interview, we talk about why Pierre set up Ank Impact Ventures, his exclusive focus on female and diverse founders and emerging female fund managers, his investment thesis, what he looks for in female founders and the founding teams, how he makes his investment decisions, and what would Pierre say to other male investors who are sitting on the fence about investing in women. I hope you enjoy this podcast interview as much as I did. Please note that this podcast interview is for informational purposes only. We do not provide investment advice. Pierre, welcome to the show. It's great to have you on. We bumped into each other at the Gender Index event. It was the launch of the 2024 report, which is all about tracking female founders and female founded businesses in the UK. And I remember you talking to me about how passionate you are in supporting female founders. So thank you for joining me. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself and your journey to where you are today?
Well, first of all, thank you for having me. This is officially my first formal podcast. So big step for Ank Impact Ventures and myself. By way of background, I'm Canadian, born and raised in Toronto. Spent more than 35 years in the real estate advisory business, primarily advising ultra high net worth families, sovereign wealth funds, institutions, private equity firms, and owners and operators of real estate globally. I've had different career posts. I've been in large banks. I've had my own real estate asset manager for over a decade. I've advised university endowments, and I've been a consultant in, I guess, you know, there are various phases to the genesis of Ank Impact Ventures. It's an investment company. I'm the sole shareholder investor in the vehicle. And it may be one of the world's first gender lens investment companies. So I'm back in Toronto after having lived in New York, Berlin, Frankfurt, London. And I founded Ank Impact Ventures in 2020.
And why did you decide to set it up? You know, what was the impetus for you to step into this? And what makes it unique in the market?
Well, you know, it's been a journey, and there have been milestones in that journey, which have sort of together created the genesis for Unc Impact Ventures. There was a time in my life where I was solely a believer in the philanthropic charity model, where I had set up a foundation in England in 2003 and an American one in 2006, a 501c private foundation. And I thought that the correct way to make the world a better place was through grants and areas that I was passionate about. So during that first phase from 2003 till about 2020, I was really more on the grant making, focusing on gifted underprivileged kids in art and in education. And that gave me the opportunity to interact with a lot of foundations, intergovernmental agencies, museums, art institutes, and see how they deal with missions, see how they deal with consequential, important areas that need to be improved, and how they scale them. And I think in that journey from 2003 to 2020, I came to the conclusion, personally, that the best way to scale mission is not in the philanthropic mode. And I needed to find another way to do it. I just felt that the money that gets granted into the organizations that you support and the money that goes to the field is a very small percentage of the original nominal value. I also felt personally that the alignment of interest between the organizations and the programs and the individuals working on these and the programs are not all aligned. They're bureaucratic, they're slow, they're technocratical, they're not innovative and nimble and fast, and they're not efficient with capital. And there's no incentives to provide for all those elements in those larger philanthropic organizations or institutes or education departments of museums. Incredible work they do. Very talented staff. It's where I came across very talented female individuals that were in the philanthropic world, which I felt could really be in the for-profit world. So that was one important step, which led to Unc Impact Ventures. Another one was, as I was a consultant from about 2015 to 2020, helping early growth and late stage venture companies, I came across a lot of women who didn't necessarily run those startups or growth companies, but were valuable members of the senior management. And I found that they were very, very talented and extremely mission-oriented and very progressive in their thinking.
I just want to add that just because you're mission-orientated doesn't mean that you're not interested in performance, right? And generating or creating a for-profit organization. As soon as you start talking about mission, purpose, a lot of people misunderstand and think that it far outweighs any profit type considerations or performance. And that's not the case.
Not at all. In fact, if we're going to talk about that now, some of the reasons I chose to create a gender lens investment thesis backing female co-founded or led businesses, startups, and first-time VC managers, incubators, accelerators, is because of the ability to interwove the mission and the impact into the business MVP, which actually creates a faster growth in the company, together with other reasons. But that's one of the reasons. It's all about diversity and being a mission-driven founder, interwoving that with the business plan and making it part of the mission of the business. There is a fallacy that doing good and focusing on consequential important issues takes away from alpha, where actually it increases alpha.
Such an important point, Pierre. I mean, I know that. A lot of female entrepreneurs know that. But you talk generally in the market and to especially male investors, and they don't think that.
Absolutely.
So do you exclusively invest in female founders and emerging female fund managers?
So I would say that the majority of our investment thesis, so we have a gender lens and diverse investment thesis. Diverse is a big word, depends on which country and which culture you're in. They have different meanings. But I would say the majority of our investments are focused on the area of women co-founded or led businesses and co-founded or led first-time VC fund managers. So people who identify themselves as a woman.
Can you share a little bit more about your investment thesis? So in addition to focusing on female founders, emerging female fund managers, diverse founders, how else are you thinking about what you invest in?
We have three important levers or strategies that we follow UNC Impact Ventures. And the importance of those three work together. So we're talking about very important tackling the most pressing and interlinked societal changes. We're talking about empowering diverse perspectives, which are the female co-founded or led. And we're talking about leveraging science for impact. And if you get the secret sauce right, putting those three together will create consequential change and deploy catalytic early stage capital to diverse change agents across the globe. We'll be able to unlock impactful ventures to build a more sustainable future. And the most important part of that are the female co-founders or leaders of that company. Because I feel that if a founder has a mission and comes from a mission perspective, in some cases, adverse, difficult past has caused the mission. And I can give you examples of that along our discussion, which makes it even more powerful because she has had a life-threatening or early childhood experience which caused a lot of suffering, and is going to tackle this by the mission of creating a business around solving that. It's all about solution. So the individual, there has to be a founder advantage. So I would say we lean more about the background and the history and the mission of the founder than the IP and the tech and the MVP and the pure financial.
Because all of that can change, right?
and then the financial. It's all about the who more than the what.
How do you go about getting to know the founder and the founding team? Because I agree with you, especially at the very early stage, it is about the founder, the team. How do you make sure that you really get to know them and know who you're investing into?
I think there's a couple of parts to that. First of all, how do you find them? That's number one. And two, how do you get to know them is number two. So are you asking me both?
I was actually thinking specifically about how do you do your, whether due diligence is the right word, but how do you really get to know who the founder is? That's really who what you're investing into.
So there's a couple of elements to that. The first element to that is more academic and analytical, which is we've put together quite a detailed AIV investment questionnaire, which is over 40 or close to 50 questions now, which gives the founder or founders the chance to, through oral dissertation, put pen to paper and give us answers to what we feel are very important questions and give us a good insight into their psychology, into their business thinking, into their mission, into their MVP. So that's one, that's more mind. And an incredible young graduate from University of Chicago and Yale, who was a student at those universities, helped me with that in the early days of UNC Impact Ventures back in 2020, 2021. The second component of that is spending time with the founders or founder. Obviously, during COVID, we were limited to video. And post-COVID, we had the benefit of being able to have face-to-face meetings again. So we generally, although I've been impulsive once or twice, but we generally have a 2-3 month process where we really want to get to know the founder or founders, both from the analytical, academic, and as well as the personal side. And that might take even a little bit longer, depending on where they are in their journey. It could take longer, but it takes usually 2 to 3 months. And part of it are the questionnaires and the Zoom or video calls, and part of it are face-to-face meetings. Also, we bring in consultants, and I've had about a dozen consultants so far who usually are experts in that field or are generalists, but they have a very good knowledge of early stage startups who assist me with that journey. So we've always had consultants from different disciplines assist us. We also have an international advisory council now, which you may have seen on our website, of over 50 members, majority female, who also assist me with that. So we have the questionnaires, we have the video calls, we have the in-person, and then we have the consultants, and we have the international advisory board. And all those 3 or 4 or 5 even elements assist with the what you call due diligence.
What would you say are the sort of top 3 or top 5 attributes of a female founder that you look to invest in?
First of all, we have to clarify what stage we invest in. We invest in pre-seed and seed, a lot of the time pre-revenue. I just came back from Cambridge University this morning, where I spent the weekend with the most incredibly talented, magical students at Lucy Cavendish College, where we held the first female student startup pitch competition in the history of Cambridge's colleges.
I remember you were telling me this, Pierre, at the event last week.
For a university that's established in 1209, I told the president, it's a little late.
So you mentioned last week was how actually there are very few female pitch entrepreneur pitch competitions in some of the major universities and colleges.
Almost none.
In the UK, which absolutely shocked me. But you're looking to change that.
I'm hoping to be part of that change. I mean, you know, 5 years ago, there was nothing, right? 10 years ago, it was a dream. But obviously, there's a huge momentum also from a regulatory and a government incentive and tax benefits. And there's a number of elements that are helping to initiate that. There are female organizations and clubs, which have, as you know, you're probably members of some of them, which have sprouted over the last 5-7 years, but probably not 10 or 15 years ago. It's rather new. It's in the last 10 years. So yes, there aren't many. We started our first female pitch competition in the UK with University of East London in the Royal Docks. And our second one was this weekend with Lucy Cavendish College at the University of Cambridge. We had 2 categories. We had a non-commercial category, and then we had a kind of pre-seed category. One was a grant, one was an investment. And, you know, if you look on Lucy Cavendish's website or their social media, or LinkedIn, you'll see all the results of that. Quite fascinating. And we're quite pleasantly surprised at who won and what they're doing and how impactful for the world it is what they're doing.
The competitions are an opportunity for female founders to obviously present and pitch a panel of judges for a prize, X amount of money, which will help them in growing the business. It's a really important way to promote these female founders, their businesses, to showcase what they've done, and then to win money and or access further funding.
Correct. So there are typically 2 elements to it on the financial side, and there's a long runway to get to last weekend. So on the financial side, there are existing students of universities and alumni. Usually they don't allow alumni more than 5-year-old, right? And some of these alumni have gone on to other universities or even in the workplace. And there's a grant typically for the less commercialized startups, female co-founded or led. And then there's a prize, which is an economic investment for the more advanced ones, which would be equivalent to, say, a pre-seed level. You know, that's a gray area. What's pre-seed? And pre-pre-seed, but commercially viable for pre-seed investment to seed the startups. And they range between 10 and 25,000 pounds, dollars, euros. And the grants are typically between 5 and 10, and the investments are 10 to 25. Princeton University, we did their first ever female pitch competition. The winners received 25,000, equivalent of a safe note investment, which is a hell of a lot of money for young students who've got a clever idea that they drummed up at university, in many cases, undergraduate, let alone graduate students. But yes, so we've done a number of them in US and UK, and we're looking to move into high schools in 2025 with the same thesis for the graduating year of high schools. The earlier you can institute female initiatives, the better.
Yeah. Are you happy to share how much capital you're deploying per female founder or their business and or an emerging female fund manager?
The range on the direct pre-seed and seed side ranges from 10,000 to 100, with the sweet spot around 50,000. And sometimes we start smaller at 10, and we agree to a pathway where we get that up to 50 over a 6 to 12 month period based on milestones with the founders. In the first-time female VC fund managers, generally we don't try to do LP investments of less than, say, 25,000, but we've gone up to 250. And I would say our sweet spot is about 100,000, but we've done smaller and we've done larger. So the sweet spot is more like 25 to 50 for the pre-seeds and seeds, maybe a little higher, 50, and the first-time VC managers, sort of 100.
Pierre, how do you decide how you're going to allocate? So in terms of your overall portfolio, I'm thinking about, so your overall portfolio construction, you've obviously made X number of investments. Am I right in thinking you've made about 22 investments in female founders?
We have 28 portfolio companies. We've lost one in 4 years.
That's very good. So keeping that in mind, how are you thinking about investing, say, this year?
So America is the most important venture market in the world from a consumer as well as an innovation center, without doubt. So about 50% of our 40 to 50%, I think it's around no less than 40, around 40% of our portfolio is American-based companies. And to date, we've invested in Britain, UK, and continental Europe, EU, Germany, France are the big ones. So we've got sort of four markets right now, Germany, France, UK, and US, of which America is probably the largest, if not almost half. And then pretty much like economies, Germany would be the next biggest one, followed by UK and then France. So we've been sticking to the sort of bigger economies. And it's a combination of the ecosystems around the schools that we have been building relationships with, and the cities in which we're getting our best deal flow from. So Paris, London, New York, LA, Miami, Frankfurt, Stuttgart, Berlin. We're following the same thesis for the VC first-time fund managers, as I mentioned to you. We're mirroring that strategy. We're overweight US, definitely, and we're developing more first-time VC fund managers in other markets that are more regionally focused or even thesis focused.
And do you have a cap on how much you're investing in the US this year in 2024 and then the UK and Europe?
No, we haven't really put a cap on. I mean, obviously we have budgets, you know, but we can't invest more than certain amounts because of just financial resources. But I think in 2024, if things go our way, we hope to maybe make something like another 6 or 8 investments globally, of which a disproportionate amount will be in the US, probably 3 to 4 or 5, and then the rest in Europe. We are looking at South America, in some of those markets, Argentina, Brazil, Chile. And we're looking at some of the other EU markets that we're not in yet, Spain, Portugal, Poland, Czech Republic. We have not started to investigate Asia, although we are in very early discussions with a couple of universities in Asia, which will probably be our first port of call, whether it's Tokyo or Singapore, we're not sure yet. And around the ecosystems of the school, which we end up doing a female student pitch competition with, will probably be where it sort of starts. Back in 2020, 2021, we started with California State University in their Los Angeles school. And so we did investments in the LA area as we got to know the academic ecosystems of Caltech, USC, UCLA. Also, as these kids tend to go on to do, some of them to do graduate work at these schools, and some of their incubators and accelerators and garages that they have in their various departments. So it kind of starts with the universities, you know, and then from there, we meet those university ecosystems and out it goes. That's our approach. We're very much working with the universities or students who've come out of certain universities who introduce us to their university ecosystem. And that's where a lot of it comes out of. So,
and it takes time, Pierre, I'm guessing, to build those relationships. And obviously, you're looking at such a wide footprint globally. So I guess you have to be patient. You have to put in the time. You have to be genuinely interested and learning about these ecosystems. They're all going to be slightly different. The markets are obviously very different. The companies are going to be different.
The disciplines are different. The backgrounds of the students are different on many levels. Everything culturally, ethnically, in some cases, juristically, many different in the matrix. It's a complex matrix. But you can't just walk into Princeton or Cambridge and, you know, do this. It takes a lot of time and energy building up trust. Their reputations are at stake. And there's a lot of commitment. The actual pitch competition days, that's the easiest. It's the preparation and the mentoring and the coaching for the 3 months or four before with the students. And then I always say to them, the easy part is winning. You know, we just had a winner at Cambridge University. And I said to her and her team, this was the easy part, the last 3-4 months. Now's the hard part. Now you have to focus on so many things. And we've developed a platform which helps not only the students, but the startups and the fund managers with various specialized skills to assist them along their journey, which is part of the formula of success.
What is it about when you go in, you approach these universities and schools soon as well? What's in it for these universities, for these academic institutions? Why do they want to work with you?
Well, first of all, they see that I'm sincere about it. I have a track record now of, you know, depending on when they met me, but it's now 4 years and 4 or 5 schools, universities. I think they have a very progressive, open-minded approach, but it's very much based on curriculum and what's the best for the school and the students. It's not about fast money or success, or it's about learning the skills of entrepreneurship and how does that integrate with their curriculum? How do those enterprise skills match their university mission and curriculum to prepare the male and female students for failure, to prepare them for an entrepreneurial journey, and to prepare them with self-confidence? And I think it's more about the school, their mission, and the curriculum, and how does this enhance them? And definitely entrepreneurship, fostering entrepreneurship at the student level supports a lot of the important areas that they want to equip their students with for the real world. So I believe that I'm a complementary business partner in that sense, that mirrors what they're looking to do and adds it and helps it. Coming to women and female students, well, the abysmal facts are that, you know, and there's different numbers that different people around the world shout out, but women as a whole, before you break down into ethnic and groups, are getting in general below 2% as a group of the pie in venture and investment across the entire ecosystem, not pre-seed or seed or venture. Or so the numbers are dismal in that respect. And, you know, I was speaking to a Nigerian woman or a South African woman last weekend. The numbers are even lower there for them than 2%. It's far less than 1% over there where they are. So how are the universities going to play a leadership role in helping female entrepreneurs at the student level to help with having more of them participate? And that will lead to potentially more capital going into female co-founded or led businesses. So I think we're part of the solution. We're not all the solution, but by backing female also helps them with the participation in the sciences, in engineering, more participation in taking those kinds of courses, and then applying those skills from academia into commercialization in an entrepreneurial way. So it's also attendance in certain courses, which are low, right? There are more male engineers graduating than female, right? And other areas. So there's a number of benefits, let's say, for teaming up. It raises awareness. It gets them more confidence. And it also, hopefully, creates confidence in male investors to put more capital into female-led or co-founded businesses. I mean, that's one of my objectives, is to move that needle, right? I mean, 50% of the planet's consumer is a woman, yet less than 2% is capital that goes into them. And the irony of all this is some of those businesses are women founder advantage businesses, where men have no idea about certain beauty products or feminine or women's health, for example. I mean, what does a man have any knowledge of as much as women do who experience it, to talk about certain products and services? And then they don't get the capital to build these businesses. So they're vacuums. I mean, I'll give you a very good example. If I could give you an example of one of our companies, that we invested in very early is called Mission Driven Tech. It's an American company founded by a Google executive who was diagnosed with cervical cancer and was pregnant 6 months with her second child and left Google and had to take on a very difficult process of radio oncology with medical equipment, which is antiquated from the 70s. So together with her radio oncologist, they formed a company after she recovered and applied her experience and mission to expanding global access to quality cervical healthcare. How is a man going to do that, you know? And her business partner and chief medical officer was the one who effectively saved her in the hospital. And then the hospital backed her. So you've got a cervical cancer survivor who leaves their job, decides to dedicate this second chance in life, horrendous experience, on a medical instrument, which I've been told by her was designed in the 70s, and the hospitals globally haven't put a dime into advancing this medical instrument, which I won't get into too much detail, but there's, I think, about 5 procedures, and a third of women pass away because they don't complete the procedures, because the pain and the mental and the surrounding medical effects of that cause enormous issues, internal bleeding, huge mental issues and physical issues. And you combine those 3 and apparently a third of women don't complete it. And I think 300,000 American women who are traumatic pass away because of that. So I know very little about cervical cancer. I am not a medical doctor. I did get some consultants to help me. But the fact of the matter is there has been no advancement in global cervical cancer for this particular procedure and medical instrument since the 70s, because the resources haven't gone into it.
It's a very powerful story, Pierre. I mean, speaks volumes.
Yeah. And that first 10,000 we invested in, whilst it's not a lot of money, probably in the scheme of things today, it was then. And that's a mission. And now this is where people are misunderstanding or miseducated. They think that investing in a mission-driven startup like inventing the world's newest cervical cancer instrument for a certain procedure is a philanthropic effort. But it's not a philanthropic effort. There is a misnomer or a wrongly evaluated, we talked about this earlier, you're going to not only make an enormous amount of money on this business and the sponsorship of the stakeholders involved and investors, but you're going to make a huge difference to not only hundreds of thousands of women in the United States who don't go through the process, but millions of women around the world at the same time, which is good for husbands and children and parents and aunts and nephews. And it just, you know, so, you know, I think there's a bit of a misunderstanding of what mission and impact are and that they reduce profits. Actually, they increase profits in certainly in that particular example I gave to you. And of course, it's a powerful example, but those are the kinds of founders we're looking for. They're mission driven.
I'm 100% with you. I think it's such a powerful example. And women's health, as we know, is chronically underfunded. I read this shocking stat, Pierre, which you may be familiar with, that 80% of health VC investors have like never invested in women's health.
We have four verticals. I didn't really discuss that with you, but I'm happy to discuss the verticals. And you'll see that healthcare and life science is one of those four investment verticals. So we just mentioned healthcare and life science. So that's one of our four pillars of investment area with a strong focus on mental health, wellness, terminal health, med tech, deep tech. We have sustainable consumption, which is software and hardware, materials, smart materials, sustainable materials, traceability, supply chain. It's a big area, conscious consumer. And again, there's this same misnomer that if you're wearing a sustainable, ethical, moral piece of clothing, that must cost you a lot more money and you're not going to make as much profit and less people are interested because they're really only interested in glamour names and big luxury names. It's completely changed, whether it's from a supply chain, whether it's from, it's coming from the pressures of a publicly quoted company who have shareholders who are pressuring them, the board, the UN sustainability goals that they align themselves to, consumer. There's a number, regulatory, we forgot that one. In certain countries like France, they impose stiff regulatory penalties on you if you burn your clothes or you don't have a certain supply chain certificates. There are rules coming into play that haven't hit the United States yet, but will. It's just a matter of time. And then obviously when those regulations are imposed, the whole world for their supply chain changes. So there's also regulatory changes coming from the governments, you know, with regards to sustainability. Then we have climate tech and smart cities, and that's a very powerful area from built environment, prop tech, climate. So one of our investments is a company in Miami called Kind Designs, founded by Anya Freeman, a Ukrainian, moved to Israel, brought up in US, in Miami, trained lawyer, worked in criminal law, and realized that Florida is slowly but surely sinking because the water levels, particularly if you take Miami as a city, which is probably arguably sort of the most popular hot city in America right now, is getting, I don't know, between 1 and 1.5 inches of increase in water levels every year. So if you wait till 2040 or 2100, the portions of entire Miami go underwater. So she's designed a 3D printed seawall that's low carbon, that has reefs and sensors, and even art outside, empowering young emerging artists. And the first one dropped, I think, in the water a month or two ago. She's raised $5 million, oversubscribed by 50%, and could effectively fill every marina and home on the water and building on the coastal east and west coast of Florida eventually.
I think we'll need them over here, Pierre, with the River Thames.
Yeah, for the same price as the cement one with none of those other benefits. So that's a mission-driven founder. You know, you can make money and help the citizens and the residents of Florida.
That's a fantastic idea, fantastic business.
Absolutely. So that's one in that area. And then we have inclusive digital economy, which also includes a number of education, skills, and jobs, and affects a lot of the UN sustainability goals. And if you look on our portfolio, you'll find the chart, which is public and fully available to anyone who's on the website. We have case studies on every single company and fund. We don't hide anything. We explain how we think there's measurable impact there, how it aligns with UN sustainability development goals, and how the companies are doing. So transparency is an integrated part of success.
I think it's fundamental. And I was going to ask you this question. How do you measure the success of the businesses?
So first of all, we have the privilege to be private. We don't have LPs. We don't have corporates behind us. Our money, our family money. And as a result of that, we can afford to be patient. And it takes 7 to 12 years for these businesses to really blossom. So the VC model of, 5, 6, 7, 8 years in general to get out is a certain kind of model. It might not fit every company. They all love the bragging rights of some of these incredibly important VC firms to join them. And that's important when the check size is very large. But the disconnect between time and money, unfortunately. So you need to have sometimes a little bit more patient capital in order to get the success. And it just doesn't come in 5 years.
I think that's such an important point, Pierre. You know, if you start putting startups under pressure, which obviously VCs do, you can kill the startup. And we've seen that happen.
You can not just kill the startup. You could, as a result of the way in which the founders are having to deal, it's challenging for them. I don't want to get into too much detail, but there are challenges for female founders with some of those pressures that affect family life, marriage, children, parents. And it's not just about money, unfortunately. And then you'll lose them, so to speak. And if they check out, it's not good for the business or themselves. So it is my understanding that this first wave of venture capital, which started, I think, if you go back to sort of Venrock, which were the Rockefellers' first VC initiative, from my understanding, in the late 60s, early 70s, Lawrence Rockefeller started this incredible vision of backing innovation at an early stage. I think that first model obviously has changed to expecting faster results and successes in a shorter period of time. And it would be my analysis that the venture model started back in the 60s and early 70s will go through other changes as the generational change of entrepreneurs have included a different profile of founders and will probably have to change their model a little bit, as I would say, to a more caring capital conscious model, and maybe also a little bit more patient capital model. And I wouldn't be surprised if you see more vehicles with a 15 to 20 year horizon. I believe MIT's The Engine, if you look into that, has a longer period in their VC funds, and they've done, I think, 2 or 3 of them. I visited them last summer, and they've decided to take a longer strategic view on next generation entrepreneurs than the current model. So I would predict there'll be more commingled and aggregated vehicles with a longer model and with more impact and measurement also attributed to them. I think that's going to be a trend that'll happen, especially as the governments and the large charities and foundations enter the fray. So as these big foundations around the world move their billions of dollars into aligning their grants with for-profit investment, so they have effectively what's called a double bottom line. It supports the founder or founder's vision of mission on the grants, but they also invest in those areas, giving them this double bottom line result, right? As they move from a grant-making only investment, and apparently I don't know how you view this, but or how you analyze this, but foundations invest very small in impact right now, so to speak, but they grant largely, right? So they invest less in impact, but when they give their grants, which is a small portion of their assets, they're very impactful, right? So I would predict that that shift is going to happen in the next 5 to 10 years, where the large, where government organizations and not-for-profit foundations will move away and from a grant-making model to a for-investment and grant-making model, aligning with their underlying priorities set to them when they were set up, the principles and articles when they were set up, which will give them a double bottom line. And I think people will invest longer.
The implication there is that startups that are addressing the more complex problems where you do need 10, 15, 20 years to really get to the root of it and build out a business that makes sense, these businesses will get funding. There's going to be more money going into them. We need these startups to be addressing these fundamental issues, whether we're talking about climate change or women's health, right?
Look at climate. You mentioned climate change. I mean, as things heat up, so to speak, excuse the pun, and as time runs out for this generation, because people tend to only really care about things when they show up in front of their driveway, there'll be a huge increase in capital going in to solve these issues or try to reduce the problems if they can. Then everyone will get very mission-oriented, won't they? When Miami's underwater and when New York City is smoke every day, then boy, will the people get interested in mission. So it's a bit of a double standard, I know. But unfortunately, people only see as long as their nose, and only when things get hot and the fire is burning, do they have to turn the fire off. So yeah, absolutely. You know, I'm with you on that.
It's very short-sighted, but you know, this is why we need investors like you, Pierre, founders and female founders that are already seeing the issues and the challenges, you know, many, many years ahead and doing something about it.
But I wanted to talk about one other area that we touched on, if you let me, and that is why female founders. We didn't really talk about it, but
this was my next question. Yeah. Obviously, a lot of my listeners are very aware of why female founders are a smart investment. But I'd love to hear you talk about it, Pierre, from your point of view, and how female fund managers, how they stand out and how they compare to male peers.
Well, look, I was at the Gender Index event where you were, where Jill was speaking, right? And you've got the statistics there on the wall, and you can look at different peer-reviewed and consultant documentation, but it's just a matter of pure and of research that 2.5 times more revenue generated by women than men in early and growth stage businesses. I mean, it's been reviewed and analyzed a million times by many organizations, but I guess the guys don't believe it. They don't believe the facts. So there's an arbitrage. I mean, let's just forget about human capital and harmony between masculinity and femininity, and women are 50% of the consumer and human reasons. Let's just be alpha, okay? Let's just talk about pure making money for a second. The irony is women perform 2 to 2.5 times better than men on monies invested than all male founder teams in early and growth businesses. They have proven a better risk management oversight and 25% more likely to outperform with male peers on EBIT margins, and without doubt create a lead senior management team that is a more positive and inclusive work in culture and hire staff and team members for talent. It is a pure talent issue. And those management decisions of a positive and inclusive work culture, better risk management, result in this more than 2.5 times performance. They're stuck at, you know, in fact, it's going down. They're even less than they were a few years ago in terms of capital allocation by venture. So female founders perform better on many dimensions.
And I think just to jump in, Pierre, I think one of the reasons is that women just have to make do with less money, right? A lot of women start their businesses, they bootstrap, they use their savings. It takes longer for them to raise money. When they do raise, they raise less money than their male peers. So they have to make do with less. And usually female founders get a lot further along before they get that funding, and they're much closer to a product market fit, for example. And to be honest, they have to be well above average to make it through the journey, because it's just so much harder for them than it is for men on average.
Absolutely. So, you know, that's the kind of some of the reasons why I decided on a gender lens investment thesis. I mean, if you don't believe everything else, believe the arbitrage and just stick to alpha, which is not the reason we're doing it purely. But, and as a result, I'm sure that's your next question. I have 28 portfolio companies. I've been at this only 4 years, so I'm just learning we're learning our way. I've had one company close in those 4 years, and 26 of them alive and kicking and moving from pre-seed to seed to A, and in a difficult environment, may I add, in 2023. No fun for many people in 2023. Very tough year. You know, I might be a brilliant angel investor, but it's not me. It's them.
The female founders are exceptional. They
I'm lucky. I'm a lucky angel investor, but you know, luck only takes you so far, right?
Pierre, I'm going to come to the last question now. And thank you for sharing everything you have. And I really appreciate you being so open and honest and transparent in how you're thinking about investing in female founders and emerging female fund managers. I think it's phenomenal. It's really, really important work.
Thank you. Thank you.
My last question is, what would you say to other male investors who might be sitting on the fence about investing in women, female founders, or are simply ignoring the market altogether? You've just mentioned there, we know the stats, and the stats have been available for many, many, many years about how female founders outperform. You know, what do you say to these men?
Well, the ones who have daughters, I say, shame on you. I mean, don't you want the best for your daughters and granddaughters? Don't you want to have an equitable world? Don't you want them to succeed? So that's the first thing I would say to fathers of daughters and grandfathers of granddaughters. I'm sure they want the best for their daughters and granddaughters. And the best thing you can do is invest in them, as they can invest in themselves, right? Which the best investment is, as Warren Buffett says, is in yourself, whether that's health or academics, without doubt. That's the most valuable asset on earth, the human capital, right? So that's what I would say. I would also probably say that a lot of our bigger problems will be solved when you give that talent pool a stake at the table to whether geopolitical issues or dietary issues, and how we eat, and how we're all probably not eating as healthy as we should globally, as academic and education learning. And the best education comes from home, by the way. It all starts at home, and the mother plays a very important role in that. So the sooner my fellow male, you know, angel investors and venture capital appreciate that more and realize that that solves bigger problems, which a lot of them have put a lot of money into their philanthropic plans later in life, the successful, financially successful ones, you can do it sooner. You know, you don't have to wait for your philanthropic foundation at the end of your life and your legacy. You can start earlier by backing female entrepreneurs on a mission for profit and have both profit and purpose. That's what I tell them.
Well said. Pierre, thank you so much for your time.
Oh, thank you very much. I'm very grateful. And thank you for giving me a voice.
It's an absolute pleasure. And I hope we can have you back on maybe in 12 months' time or so, where you can tell us how it
would be a pleasure. Absolutely.
All right. Thank you. Thank you for joining me today. If you would like to connect with me, you can find me online at Join the Purse, or you can subscribe to our newsletter, jointhepurse.substack.com. Until next time, goodbye.